The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Inside Healthcare, critical thinking for turbulent times. Your host is Robert Chamberlain. Our show takes an honest look at the healthcare industry at a time when there are more questions in this industry than ever before. Now, here is your host, Robert Chamberlain.
Good morning and hello and welcome back. I am Robert Chamberlain, your host for Inside Healthcare, critical thinking for turbulent times. And as the intro of the show suggested, this is the only radio show dedicated to what's intended to be a vibrant discussion of the healthcare industry with a very strong focus on current events and how they're shaping strategy and how they impact hospitals, health systems, physicians, and the aligned constituencies all adjacent to this industry called healthcare. We like to begin each show by taking a look back over the previous week and condense for you relative events that shape the ebb and flow of healthcare. It has been a very, very busy week. And so joining me today is Ms. Holly West, who is Executive Vice President of Communications and Operations for Applied Health Analytics. Good morning, Holly.
Good morning, Bob.
So we do have a lot of news to cover within a relatively short period of time. Let's get it started. And as always, let's start by taking a look at the Affordable Care Act and what has transpired over the previous week that impacts us.
It's actually been a very busy week. I feel like I say that every week, but this week was really, truly busy. There's more on the saga of whether or not the IRS exceeded its authority in providing tax credit subsidies in the 34 states not running their own insurance exchanges. As you know, the Affordable Care Act grants subsidies to eligible individuals in states that have established their own health exchange. And within an 18-hour period, about 10 days ago or so, the D.C. federal courts had ruled that the Obama administration did overstep its authority. But then the U.S. Court of Appeals in Richmond, Virginia, said it did not because the language is ambiguous. But both courts agree that without the individuals eligible for subsidies in the state, you really can't have employer penalties. Now, D.C. ruling may be reviewed en banc, and there are two additional cases, one in Oklahoma that will go to the 10th Circuit and one in Indiana that will lead to the 7th Circuit. And the thought is that unless all four of these courts agree, the Supreme Court might be forced to review.
So Justice Roberts and his team will get to weigh in again and once again determine the legality or illegality of Obamacare. Well, let me ask you this. Does this impact the employer mandate in any way?
The thought is that it might. While they're wrestling with this, there's also the IRS. The employers are waiting for the IRS to finalize the employer reporting rules and forms for the employer mandate, which was set to begin in 2015. And since the two mandates are so closely connected, experts believe that the employer mandate may be pushed back again while we wait on the decision on the individual mandate.
And in the meantime, Speaker Boehner has been busy.
Very busy. So a minute ago, I talked about the individual mandate and subsidies surrounding exchanges going to the Supreme Court. And actually, what the thought is that the court may tell Congress to fix the language and make it less ambiguous. But all of this might be for naught because the House recently passed a resolution authorizing a lawsuit challenging the president's constitutional authority to delay the employer mandate. The vote was 225 to 2001.
That's remarkable. So it looks like apparently 2015 is going to be a big year again. What else is taking place we should know about?
Well, again, in 2015, their HHS signs off on new ICD-10 laws. So basically, providers and payers and clearinghouses have until October 1st, 2015 to transition to ICD-10, according to HHS. And constituents were working really hard to try to meet an October 2014 deadline. So there is thought that maybe the progress might be halted because people don't really feel like they have that same fire.
Well, let's leave Capitol Hill for a moment and talk about the impact on carriers. And with specific regard to the legislation and the guardrails that were set up to create risk corridors, a lot of people are taking a look at that. Are the risk corridors a carrot for insurers or a bailout? How do you look at that, Holly?
To be honest, I'm not quite sure how I feel about that, but maybe more of a carrot. And as you know, the risk corridors were set in motion to try to encourage insurers to participate in the exchanges and to push premium rates down, and they have until 2016 to do so. Financial assistance is available to insurers if their exchange claim costs at least 3% more than their premium revenue. And this assistance is funded by payment from insurers who are actually making a profit of 3% or more. And this is all, there's nothing new to this. They did this with Medicare Part D. Humana expects to seek risk corridor assistance, and so does WellPoint.
So we have taxpayer funding being set up as an opportunity for insurers to more aggressively play within the exchanges. Have we seen any impact on the cost of through these same insurers?
Well, 2014, no, of course. But 2014, for 2015, everybody is starting to talk about the need to raise premium rates. So the latest, we mentioned Tennessee a couple weeks ago. The latest is Florida. And Florida Blue, which is the state's largest health insurer, is increasing premiums by an average of 17.6% for 2015. Florida Blue cites the number of older adults who previously lacked coverage as the reason why this is happening. These adults are using more services than expected. Florida Blue's actually covers 340,000 through the exchange, which is nearly 34% of the 1 million enrolled in the state. But Florida Blue, this is nothing new. They have raised premiums over the last 4 years, averaging 11%. But they're really not alone. Humana in the same state is saying they will probably increase by 14.1% for HMO and 2.2% for its PPO, and the Molina is averaging about 11.6%.
So pretty much across the board we're seeing increases. I know Deloitte came out last week with a study of the individuals who had enrolled in the exchanges, and their findings found that 28% of the individuals were in the segment known as the young invincibles, 18 to 34, which is what we're truly hoping to sign up into the exchanges. I think the government had projected that at least 40% would need to be young invincibles. We're finding it that it's indeed a smaller percentage, and we're suggesting that adverse selection is actually taking place. So we're finding out the people who are indeed signing up for the exchanges are older and less healthy. So this obviously makes a lot of sense why we're seeing premium costs go up. But how is this impacting hospitals and health systems?
Well, actually, if you're for profit, you're actually doing pretty well. In fact, Q2 numbers are in around the country, and some for profits are faring well due to an influx of newly insured patients. According to the Wall Street Journal, Universal Health Services revenue is up 10% in the second quarter of 2014 compared to the second quarter of 2013. Between one-third to one-half of its revenue bump can be traced to newly insured patients. However, their hospital admissions were up too, as were outpatient surgery volumes. They were up 4%.
So we're seeing on the hospital side of things are up, which I believe can largely be attributed to the expansion of Medicare in the 30 states that did expand Medicare. So that's very good for hospitals and health systems. What about some of the other players in the market?
Well, LifePoint Hospital's profit went up 44% compared to a year ago.
That's remarkable.
Mm-hmm. And then HCA, our very own HCA here in Tennessee, their net income rose 14% during the second quarter of this year from $423 million in Q2 last year to $483 million of Q2 this year.
That's terrific. What about Cerner? What are you seeing there? What are we seeing on the tech stocks?
Well, actually, tech is in demand, and Cerner's doing well. They work with healthcare providers who are looking for integrated information technology needs. And Cerner reported a net income of $129 million in the second quarter of 2014, which is up 14.2% from the year ago period. And revenue was up 20% to $851.8 million.
And I'm sure we can expect similar performance by McKesson and Epic and firms such as that. One of the things that I've been taking a look at, Holly, and reading a lot about is the amount of M&A, the mergers and acquisition activity that's going on. What are you seeing out there?
There's a lot going on, especially once again regarding technology. Healthcare merger and acquisition spending jumped to $135.2 million during the second quarter of 2014, a 152% increase from $52.6 billion, according to an Irvin Levin Associates report. This is a 171% increase from the $49.9 billion spent in the first quarter of this year. Experts believe that 91% of the combined spending came from technology.
So a lot of the M&A is moving from the hospital sector into the many of the aligned sectors. I think we can expect to see a lot more merger and acquisition activity, particularly as we move forward under the Affordable Care Act. But one of the questions we've had a lot about is, will we be able to move from a fee-for-service to a value-based model?
Well, according to a new study commissioned by McKesson, who surveyed 114 payers and 350 hospitals and health systems. They predict that the pay-for-performance model will experience the most growth in the next 5 years, increasing from 10 to 18% for payers and 9 to 21% for health systems. The prediction is that despite the growth, the pay-for-performance model will be the most challenging to implement. Top obstacles include not having the technology or infrastructure needed in order to measure, analyze, and capture data.
Measure, analyze, capture data. So IT is booming. Hospitals and health systems, bottom line, seem to be getting stronger. Looks like the movement from fee-for-service to value-based clearly is building ahead of steam, and all of this suggests to me that this is an industry ripe for innovation, and I know there are companies out there such as CVS and Walgreens that are moving very aggressively into this market. What are you seeing relative to, let's just call it innovation, Holly? What's going on?
It's been very interesting, actually. 24 of the top 50 companies on the Fortune 500 list are shaking up the healthcare industry. Companies who are not known for healthcare, such as Nike, Time Warner Cable, Apple, all of them are starting to move into the healthcare industry, with between CVS and their MinuteClinics and Time Warner Cable partnering with Cleveland Clinic to offer telehealth programs, Nike and their fuel ban, Apple with its health kit. But what does this mean for hospitals? Obviously, hospitals should focus on their high-value services and do what they excel at.
Well, we've heard a lot coming out of the VA, much of it concerning news. Is there any good news?
There is good news. They confirmed former Procter & Gamble CEO Robert McDonald, and also there is a new bit of legislation that's going through the House right now. There's a proposed $17 billion that is looking to accelerate the deployment of mobile clinics through telemedicine, allowing veterans to travel long distance to avoid traveling long distance and reduce their waiting time for medical services.
And we learned last week that CMS has a proposed rule that would permit for the reimbursement of telemedicine services. So that's a very big deal, and it's good to see the government moving in that direction with the Veterans Administration. Holly, thank you. It's indeed been a busy week. We look forward to hearing from you next week as we look across the landscape. And before we go, I want to invite you to return with us in a couple of minutes. We're going to introduce to you a gentleman by the name of Mr. Russ Guerin, who serves as a healthcare consultant, executive coach, and he's just a guy you want to know, you want to meet, you want to listen to. He's been in the healthcare industry for some time, and we're going to learn about what Russ sees today and what he views as an opportunity for hospitals and health systems across the country. We'll see you in a moment.
We're making it easier to listen to the Voice America Talk Radio Network live wherever you go on iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android. Download it from the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
When it comes to staying well or fighting disease, medicine knows more than it ever has. In fact, more medical knowledge has been created in the last 50 years than in the previous 500 years combined. Think about that. Promising new procedures, innovations in prevention, coming at a faster and faster pace. So how do you get medicine's greatest ideas working for you? It takes a system. At Carolina's healthcare system, thousands of doctors are connected across 900 locations, so doctors, specialists, and surgeons can share ideas across the hall or across the state. Our integrated system gives all your doctors instant access to your test results and health history, so everyone's working together, diagnosing and delivering your care. Today, building this culture of continuous learning takes a system. Connecting a network of care takes a system. Your health takes a system, working as one. To find out more, go to carolinashealthcare.org.
Ever since I was a little girl, I've been dreaming of the day that my dad would get all dressed up and walk me down the aisle on my wedding day. I even planned what he would wear, how his tux would go with my dress, things like that. I remember thinking he'll have a little more gray hair by then, but he'll still be the handsomest dad ever. Then he had his heart attack. My mom gave him aspirin and drove him to the Halifax Health Chest Pain Center. All these people were running around, moving really fast, and my dad just looked helpless, lifeless. They tried this amazing new thing, lowering his body temperature to some exact degree to protect his heart and give him a chance. They called it intravascular hypothermia treatment. They did everything they could. They took great care of him every second. And because they did, he'll be taking care of me for years to come. And now I know he'll be there to walk me down the aisle.
Halifax Health. Live your life well.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
You are listening to Inside Healthcare with Robert Chamberlain. If you would like to participate on today's show with a question or a comment, please call into our show live on Mondays at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to insidehealthcare@appliedhealth.net. Now, back to this week's program.
Good morning and welcome back. This is Robert Chamberlain, broadcasting from the Bank of America building in downtown Nashville, Tennessee, the home of healthcare within the United States. Joining us now is a gentleman by the name of Russ Guerin. And Russ serves as a healthcare consultant and executive coach for business leaders across the United States. However, prior to what Russ is currently doing, he was executive vice president for business development and planning at Carolina's healthcare system, where he led the development and implementation of community relations, public relations, managed care, strategic planning, and business development strategy. He also implemented the systems and regional employer corporate health and wellness programs. And Russ joined Carolina's healthcare system in 1987 as vice president of financial services. And he's just one of those guys that I would describe as a Renaissance man who's been in healthcare long enough. He's the sort of gentleman that we love to have on the show periodically to just gain his understanding as he looks across the landscape of what he sees happening and taking place. So good morning, Russ. How are you?
Good morning, Bob. I'm doing great. Good to talk with you.
You're loud and clear, and I assume you're in Charlotte today?
I am in Charlotte. Looking forward to going through some of the issues that are addressing our healthcare system today.
Well, thanks for joining us, and we're happy to have you. We don't have a lot of time, so if you don't mind, let me get into it. And as I look over the past 15 years or so of health systems and hospitals and look at the trends, including risk contracting, acquisitions, consolidation, disease management, wellness initiatives, medical homes, accountable care organizations, and opportunity to partner with physicians are just woven throughout. But let me sort of focus on the physician aspect of this thing. And physicians were given autonomy, but now we see systems, you know, buying more practices to meet demands of the ACA and population health. What are your thoughts on the tightening of the alignment between health systems and physicians?
Well, Bob, a lot of organizations have had a tightened alignment for a long time. So when you think of the Mayo Clinic and Cleveland Clinic, you know, those were organizations where the physicians were an integral component of the hospital system. They were sort of one and the same. But in most of the organizations, that was not the case. My prior organization, Carolina's Healthcare System, we had a small faculty component of physicians who were involved with teaching program. But in 1987, we started employing more physicians, acquiring their practices, bringing them onto the payroll, and we started this consolidation of what were previously private autonomous physicians and bringing them onto our medical staff through an employment model. And today that number has grown into the thousands. The primary driver for that is the things that you were talking about earlier, the disease management, the need under accountable care organizations to be more and more and more responsible for the not just the patient care, but the whole outcomes component of it. Patient care is now, you know, it's one part of this pie that we have to look at, but more and more of it's just so complex that you really have to have partners that you can work with, and that partnership is more than just admitting a patient to a hospital. It's now much more, there's so much more communication involved on a daily basis.
Russ, when I think about the individual, the independent physician, and the reasons why they went into private practice, I often see what I can best describe as an entrepreneur, a very well-intentioned entrepreneur who sees the opportunity to not only move in his or her own direction, but to manage a practice and provide great value back to the community and obviously their patients. But we see this new trend expanding across healthcare, where the alignment with a hospital or health system, I think it seems to become more important, you know, at least to the financial survival of the issues that physicians are facing. How do you see physicians responding to this trend?
Well, the majority of primary care physicians are employed by a healthcare system today. Most new graduates, most new physicians coming out are part of a healthcare system today. And it is a largely an economic driver. But I think, you know, that autonomy that you talked about, it wasn't just autonomy from the physician to the hospital. The autonomy was from one physician group to another group as well. And that autonomy it sacrifices some of the need that we have today in our, for instance, a disease management protocol. That disease management protocol is going to have multiple different physician specialties involved in it. They all have to follow that same protocol. That's why when you had a closed staff like the Mayo Clinic or the Cleveland Clinic, their outcomes were better. And they were better because those physicians, even though they were still autonomous in some way, in another way, they were all employees of that clinic, and they were required to follow more protocols than somebody who was just independent working out on their own.
So the movement towards evidence-based clinical integration is clearly causing physicians to work in very much a team-like environment, and obviously as there's greater communication at the patient or at the case level, there's almost unanimously a stronger outcome. But a big piece of that, Russ, is also the technology. And I was reading recently a piece of research that told us that 72% of physicians were not happy with the EHR, EMR that had been purchased for them. So there's this intense focus on data and technology as tools to coordinate care and predict health issues. But employed physicians aside, how do you think hospitals can leverage technology to better integrate with owned practices?
Well, there's no question technology is one of the keys to this complex solution. So, you know, if I have to take my child to the emergency room and I get to that emergency room and they have access to the, and I mean easy access, to all of my child's clinical information from the pediatrician's office that he sees on a regular basis, as well as any previous hospitalizations my child has had, then we're talking about data integration. We're talking about the potential for improved clinical outcomes. That we didn't have that before. The electronic medical record or the electronic health record is something that can tie all that information together. So when the treatment is being looked at, You're not looking at just a small part of it. Hopefully you're looking at, you know, 80, maybe 90% of the treatment that's been provided to that patient in the past. So prescriptions are more accurate. And you know much more of the medical history than you ever knew before. I think physicians are happy with that component of it. They want to have as much information as possible to make an informed decision. But it does take more time. It does take them away sometimes from some of the things that they would rather be doing. So it's really, this is a compromise that's going on every day. How do we keep the physician happy? How do we keep the physician motivated? But how do we also provide that physician with the best information so they can make the best clinical judgments?
Well, having an affinity for Carolina's healthcare system as I do, you guys have certainly done a good job leading us in that direction. If you're joining us, I'm speaking with Mr. Russ Guerin, who previously was Executive Vice President for Business Development at Carolina's healthcare system. He currently is serving as a healthcare consultant and executive coach for business leaders across the country. Russ, when you recently left Carolina's healthcare system, which by the way has a little over 7,400 licensed hospital beds and 900 care locations throughout North and South Carolina, you were executing a level of innovation that was impressive. And one of the areas that you were moving very aggressively into was, into population health and value-based care. And Rush, you led the development of something called HealthWorks, which is your commercial market, Carolina's healthcare system's commercial market strategy, which is intended to create bridges between the employer market and the different points of entry within Carolina's healthcare within North and South Carolina. What strategies do you feel, Russ, that hospitals and health systems could implement today to address this increasingly competitive environment? Russ, what I mean by that is not only Novant across the street, but when you're looking at the Walgreens and the CVSs and the Healthways and the Aleers and all those companies that are moving into the population health world, what strategies should health systems implement or contemplate when taking on this challenge?
You know, population health and value-based care, it's a paradigm shift, isn't it? For many years, hospitals were places people went to get well once they were sick enough to be admitted by a physician. But addressing the needs of the sick is really maybe the easier part of the equation for healthcare systems. What healthcare systems are now focused on is prevention of the disease. And that's population health and keeping the patient out of the hospital. You know, that's essential to value-based care, preventing readmissions. So our strategies had to change, and those strategies had to include a closer relationship with the patient. And that patient has to include more frequent contacts than at the hospital. So we put in different programs that were not part of a traditional hospital network. Our hospital system, we meet our patients at the mall. We meet them at work. We meet them at home. We meet them at the health department. We use social media to have frequent contacts with our patients. So we've built auditoriums at multiple locations. But what we found is frequent contact with the patient was really key to having some impact on that behavioral health change that we're trying to make to improve population health.
And as I recall, your view of the payer, you know, traditionally people think of the payer as Blue Cross Blue Shield or Aetna or United or Cigna. Your view of the payer was a little bit more localized, and that was the employer was the one who was ultimately reimbursing hospitals and health systems and physicians for the services they provide. So you tended to view the employer in a different light. What was it that made that employer strategy stand apart from, say, your traditional carrier-based negotiations or your managed care strategy?
Sure. You know, it's always been my philosophy, and I think the philosophy of others that I worked with, that we wanted to have a mutual understanding with these key constituents. And whether that constituent was the insurer or the employer, we wanted to meet with them on a regular basis to understand, you know, what were their needs, what were their desires, what were the things that were driving, you know, their budgets. In the 1980s, we started a workers' comp network that we marketed directly to employers. And in the 90s, we had managed care organizations that we marketed directly to employers. But it was our goal to meet with employers and to look for ways that we could help them keep their health care costs low, but also to make sure that they understood from our point of view, here's what we are seeing with your employees. So the feedback we would get from them was sometimes, you know, we need increased access in these areas. So we'd open up new physician clinics or urgent care locations, even freestanding emergency rooms. Sometimes it was, you know, we would put on-site clinics at the employer location. But we wanted them to know that we have mutual goals to take care of their employees at the most effective cost possible.
And how has the employer responded to that, Russ?
You know, in most situations, we had tremendous success working directly with employers. Many of those employers that we worked with in the 80s are still working with Carolina's healthcare system today. And that model has branched, as I said, from a workers' comp model to a complete patient care on-site delivery model where there is integration at levels that, you know, we never dreamed of back 20, 30 years ago. I think the employers are very positive about having as much information as they can in terms of this is the health of our employees, but also this is where we can provide, as an employer, the biggest incentives to get our employees healthier.
Which is a very interesting perspective when you consider that we've heard employers say, well, why would I ever partner with the health system because their revenue is my expense? How do you align those two, Ross? How do you, and I know that you're a huge fan of collaboration. How do you go to that employer and convince them that the health system is their best partner?
Well, I think what we have done is we've had relationships with employers But also, if they have a broker, we want their broker to be part of that meeting. If they have an insurer, you know, like an Aetna or a Blue Cross, we invite them to that meeting as well. You know, I was just, I was reading a David and Goliath, which is Malcolm Gladwell's newest book. And I'm always intrigued by his books, but one of the things that he points out in his new book is what can happen when one party assumes it knows what's best for the other. You know, where there's a lack of respect and therefore no authority. And I was relating to his story about what has happened in the healthcare system, and I think there's been a tremendous amount of lack of respect between employers and healthcare systems and physicians and insurers about, you know, what are the important ingredients, because this person we call a patient to one party is an insured or a member to another party, is an employee to a third, you know, another party, a third party, but it's the same person. So the alignment or the agreement of those four parties on how to best manage the care and the communication and the incentives and the payment for that individual is really critical to reducing healthcare expenses. It's really critical to improving the overall healthcare outcomes. And it's really critical to improving employee productivity. So, you know, I think it's proven over and over again throughout history that you have to have that mutual communication and understanding and respect for one another to have that best outcome.
Russ, I can't thank you enough for joining us today. As always, your words are insightful and give us pause to think about the importance of collaboration in today's marketplace. So I really like to thank you for coming on the show today. We've been talking to Russ Guerin, who is currently a healthcare consultant and coaching expert with executives across the United States, and was previously executive vice president of Carolina's healthcare system, where he led the strategic growth of a very sophisticated not-for-profit system within this country. So thank you, Russ. And on our return, we're going to be speaking with Mr. Craig Smith, who's the president of Coalesce, who's going to offer some insight to the physician side of the equation. So we'll talk to you shortly.
We're making it easier to listen to the Voice America Talk Radio Network live wherever you go on iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android. Download it from the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
Life is full of precious moments, moments that truly matter. And believe it or not, listening to this could actually be one of them. Because at Baptist Health, we want you to know how you might one day save a life. You see, if someone near you suddenly shows signs of a stroke, every moment matters in the race to the right care, because time lost is brain lost. At Baptist, there are now more options than ever for treating strokes when you get to us in time. Two of the best neurovascular surgeons in the country have joined Baptist to create the new Stroke and Cerebrovascular Center. Coordinating with expert stroke teams across the region, we offer fast access to every advanced treatment available for all strokes. So please, know the signs of a stroke. Call 911 immediately and get to Baptist. Together, we can offer families more precious moments that matter. That's changing healthcare for good. Visit BaptistJax.com to learn more. Again, that's BaptistJax.com.
When it comes to staying well or fighting disease, medicine knows more than it ever has. In fact, more medical knowledge has been created in the last 50 years than in the previous 500 years combined. Think about that. Promising new procedures, innovations in prevention, coming at a faster and faster pace. So how do you get medicine's greatest ideas working for you? It takes a system. At Carolina's healthcare system, thousands of doctors are connected across 900 locations, so doctors, specialists, and surgeons can share ideas across the hall or across the state. Our integrated system gives all your doctors instant access to your test results and health history, so everyone's working together, diagnosing and delivering your care. Today, building this culture of continuous learning takes a system. Connecting a network of care takes a system. Your health takes a system, working as one.
To find out more, go to carolinashealthcare.org.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
You are listening to Inside Healthcare with Robert Chamberlain. If you would like to participate on today's show with a question or a comment, please call into our show live on Mondays at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to insidehealthcare@appliedhealth.net. Now, back to this week's program.
Hello, and welcome back to Inside Healthcare, Critical Thinking for Turbulent Times. This is the weekly radio show that takes a look at the healthcare industry and tries to offer some insight as to how all the factors are impacting it. And we just were speaking with a gentleman by the name of Russ Guerin, who previously was a senior executive with Carolina's healthcare system in Charlotte, North Carolina, who offered some very very interesting insight as to a subject that can only be described as collaboration, how the different constituents within the healthcare system that touch those affiliated with the healthcare system can coalesce to bring together a better result. Joining us now, speaking of coalesce, is Mr. Craig Smith, who's the president of Coalesce, which is a division of Applied Health Analytics that works with health systems to optimize a couple of things, focusing on primary care strategies that result in increasing volume to service lines and supporting aligned physicians to grow revenue. Craig, welcome to the show. Good Monday.
Glad to be here, Bob.
So picking up on where Russ left off in that last segment, we talked about some of the global impacts of the Affordable Care Act and how it's affected strategy development for hospitals and health systems. And you spend a lot of time on jets traveling around the country, speaking with the leadership teams, hospitals and health systems. And you're participating in these conversations. What are you hearing about the financial impact of the ACA?
Bob, it's a mixed bag, really. In the for-profit sector, and particularly with systems with a fairly large national footprint, the early news has generally been good. I think I heard you and Holly mention in the first segment of the show that both LifePoint and Universal have seen a nice bump in their revenue in the second quarter compared to the same period last year. Both saw an increase of roughly 10%, and HCA posted a similar number at 9.2%. While I haven't heard the reporting on Tenet's or Community Health System's quarterly performance, the storyline seems to be similar according to the people I speak with in those organizations. They tell me that there's generally been a lift in revenue holistically, but there's a significant variance from market to market, with the most significant variable being the extent to which there's been an expansion of Medicaid in those markets. Where that's occurred, or pardon me, where that hasn't occurred, the news isn't nearly as good. I'm also hearing anecdotally that with the expansion of Medicaid and the growth of the ACA-facilitated exchanges, the lift or lack thereof is a bit of a double whammy. Many of the newly insureds are older and sicker, and the extent to which they require more hospital care drives more inpatient volume. That's obviously good, and it's candidly not surprising, given that it's certainly in line with what was behind, if you will, the grand bargain of the ACA to providers. Reimbursement rates were going to be declining, but that would be offset by an increased number of insured consumers, and that's what we're seeing. It'd be candidly very disappointing if we weren't seeing some of these results for providers at this stage of the rollout. That said, if you're in a market where there hasn't been an expansion of Medicaid or a significant enrollment in the exchanges, there just isn't a lot of reason for excitement.
Craig, in those markets in which the financial impacts of the ACA look to be near-term positive, is there a sense that this lift you discussed will be an ongoing benefit to hospitals and health systems?
Nobody I know is counting on it beyond how it affects their strategy for population health management. In other words, they're not counting on a consistent stream of newly insureds to drive big quarterly revenue increases. On the margin, and for the foreseeable future, the primary surge in newly insureds has already largely occurred. But these same people are thinking about how the adverse selection issue will create new opportunities for them to get better around the issues of coordination of care and continuity of care across delivery settings with patients once they moved out of an acute care environment. Every inpatient encounter effectively becomes another test case for how to optimize current fee-for-service income while also establishing the operational, cultural, and clinical protocols for managing patient care more over the arc of a patient's life cycle and less on an episodic basis.
Which is exactly what Russ was saying.
Yeah, and you know, another reason, Bob, that there's a sense that the current lift is likely not going to be ongoing is a general concern around the economics that underlie the exchanges currently and their long-term sustainability. Reimbursement under Medicare expansion will place a greater burden on states moving forward, and second-year increases, rate increases in the exchanges are looking fairly ominous. You mentioned the Florida Blues plans for next year earlier in the show, and those are candidly looking more like the rule than they are the exceptions. In Tennessee last week, I saw an article in which the Blues were looking to exchange their rates by 19% for the state exchange. So with that sticker shock lead to erosion, I think the smart money is betting that this will occur to some degree, and it will disproportionately occur among younger and healthier consumers. So the grand bargain may not be so grand if there isn't a real and meaningful base of healthy new consumers in the pool.
Well, Holly reported in the opening segment that the for-profits, particularly those with a presence in the states that did expand Medicare, the bottom line is looking pretty darn good. You sound a bit cynical about all of this.
Yeah, forgive me for that, Bob. As it relates to Medicare from a reimbursement standpoint, some is surely better than none. But it's kind of the reimbursement equivalent of being the valedictorian of your kindergarten class. It's still not great. I'm also not one that's convinced that the deal the government cuts with me today is going to be one that I can count on tomorrow. There are simply too many pressure points that government can disproportionately affect, and the costs continue to grow at a rapid pace. And even if some is better than none, it's still the worst of the best. I also am a little bit concerned, candidly, that some of the near-term good news can create some complacency. From the passage of the ACA in 2010 to the implementation this year, CXOs have been trying to chart a strategic course in something of a vacuum. And I think that's not surprising that in some places there's a tendency to want and need to catch one's breath. I think many of the people that I work with deserve exactly that, but it's honestly not the time. There's too much work yet to be done.
Well, how does your work with Coalesce, I mean, specifically helping hospitals and health systems collaborate with employers? I mean, obviously, Craig, it's apparent that you see that one successful path that employers can, excuse me, that hospitals and health systems can follow to get through these very turbulent times is to partner with the employers in their market. Tell me what your recommendations are relative to how these health systems can collaborate with employers, and how does this discussion that you're having with them, impact early financial results for as a result of the ACA on healthcare providers?
Yeah, anything and everything we can do to help facilitate more complete partnerships with employers on behalf of our hospital and health systems clients is foundational to their future success, unequivocally. If government reimbursement is the best of the worst, commercial reimbursement represents the best of the best. And our clients are doing better today by being more closely aligned with the commercial market. An employer strategy is clearly additive to our clients' financial success. Also, some of the early challenges of the ACA implementation in both the government reimbursement sector and with the individual exchanges are likely to play out in the commercial market. And employers represent an important seat at the table in that discussion. Rate sustainability, particularly as it relates to minimally compliant plan design, will be an issue for employers, presuming the employer mandate sticks. If and when that happens, hospitals and health systems should be prepared to provide answers for how they can help employers mitigate benefit cost increases. It creates even more reasons for them to establish those partnerships now.
So I'm putting myself in the place of a leadership team of a hospital or a health system, and you've convinced me that the commercial market strategy or working with employers is a good opportunity for us to proceed in. What next? What do we do next? What would Coalesce do in that case to help us orient our strategy?
The first best thing that we can do is identify those employers in a hospital or health systems market area who have an appetite for partnering. Not everybody is at the same place, and we need to be able to address those early adopters who want to get ahead of these costs today. Once we've identified, you know, those organizations who are most likely to partner in a meaningful way, then we've got to gather data that we can aggregate on behalf of those employers to show them uniquely what is driving healthcare cost within their workforce, and then on an individual basis, be able to have meaningful conversations with those employees who can do some things today in terms of lifestyle choices and modifiable behaviors that will prevent them from becoming tomorrow's unhealthy.
But I'm saying, wait a minute, Craig, I have an occupational health product. I have a wellness component. I think I have all the things necessary as a hospital or health system to partner with employers. Do you typically find that is the case?
I often hear that is the perception. And then when you begin to dig a little bit deeper into what their perception of an employer program is relative to the employer's perception of that relationship, there's often a disconnect. And our challenge in working to bridge the relationship between providers and employers is first and most importantly to get both on the same page. And one of the things that we routinely hear from employers is they have, because of the way you actually couch that question, you know, it leads me to believe that you've heard some of what I'm hearing, and that's that hospitals tend to approach this from a service line perspective, meaning that they may have multiple individuals from the hospital calling on the same people within the employer community that are also talking to other service line managers from the hospital. It's confusing, it's sub-optimized, and at the end of the day, it doesn't recognize the holistic relationship that the hospital has to have with the employer that cuts across all of their service lines.
I remember working with a health system and a very sophisticated group, and the CEO stated to me that he wasn't sure that they had organized a sophisticated employer strategy. And I think the result of the coalesce work was they found out, indeed, there were 8 different individuals within your organization calling on employers. And interestingly, sometimes with different business cards, certainly with different messages. Does that create a level of confusion at the employer level?
It absolutely does. And our goal is to create an umbrella, if you will, through which all of the hospital services can be introduced. One primary point of contact that represents the entire portfolio of services that an employer may want to use to mitigate increases in healthcare benefit costs.
You know, we were talking earlier with Russ Guerin, who is a senior executive at Carolina's healthcare system, and they kicked off a pretty sophisticated, in fact, certainly a market-leading strategy, which I believe they branded HealthWorks, where they created an organization headed up by its own president. And one of the things that Russ said early on is that we intend to make this every bit a commitment to the employer market by calling it a service line, and it would carry the same gravity and weight as many of the expenditures that we have on some of the other specialties that we bring to market. So the point of the service line was to cut across the silos and pull together the different competencies within the health system in almost a clinically integrated way to go back to that employer with a uniform and meaningful message, because they felt that the competition for this segment of the market wasn't necessarily a hospital across the street. It was a different group of competitors, now for-profit, publicly traded company. So, Craig, what is your advice to the hospital or health system that wants to wade into this marketplace and view themselves as a vendor?
Well, the first thing that I would say is those who go first go best. So there's no time like the present in terms of moving on this initiative. The other thing is that they're, for my money, one of the truly outstanding elements of the ACA is it's created an appetite on the part of employers thinking that the employer mandate was going to be occurring to get ahead of some of this stuff before they see the cost of providing a minimally compliant plan under the ACA to their workforce. So moving on it immediately, I think, is the first best thing that they can do.
Well, clearly, when you wade into this water, as I said earlier, the health system is a vendor because the employer is going to look at you very, very differently. They're, you know, when you make the promise of being able to manage the health of a population at the employer level, they're viewing it as not only as an employee health enhancement model, but a cost containment model. So they're taking it very, very seriously. Craig, any parting messages before I let you go?
These are exciting times, and we're enjoying what we're doing. We're having a blast in the marketplace, and the ability to put these constituencies together in a meaningful partnership is rewarding every day.
Well, Craig, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. I want to thank Mr. Russ Guerin, who came in at the top of the hour, and Ms. Holly West, who is also very helpful in taking a look back over the previous week. We will return next Monday at 8 a.m. Central Time. We hope you enjoyed today's show. Remember to join us, because next week we have joining us is Mr. Brian Sivak, who's Chief Technology Officer at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Brian's going to be here next week so we can discuss data, perhaps big data, and the healthcare startup ecosystem. So I'd like to end by thanking Ms. Holly West, our executive producer, Brett Comer, our engineer, and Brett Henderson, our intern. Until next week, I am your host for Inside Healthcare, Critical Thinking for Turbulent Times. Thank you for listening to our show.
Thank you for joining us this week for Inside Healthcare. Robert Chamberlain will be back live next week on Monday at 9 a.m. Eastern Time, 6 a.m. Pacific Time. You may also catch our weekly replay on Saturdays at noon Eastern Time, 9 a.m. Pacific Time, both on the Voice America Business Channel. We'll see you on the next show.